Okay, Sunday, June 2025. Man. So I was talking to Kashanti last week or the week before, and I said, Kashanti, did you hear this one? Everyone dies three times, it has been said. He said, no. What does that mean? Well, the first death is when our body stops breathing. And then the coroner comes and says, you're dead. The second death happens when we get buried and have a funeral service. And one of my favorite YouTube channels is Hollywood Graveyard. And they go to these different graveyards and they stop right at the headstone. And then they tell you who's buried there and what they did, what kind of life they had. A lot of celebrities, a lot of successful people, but I have found every time I've done a memorial service, I've always learned more about the person after they're dead than when they were alive. And I just wish sometimes they were still alive so I could talk to them, ask them some questions. The third way we die, the final way we die, is when the last person on earth speaks our name. Yeah. So today I'm talking about Dr. Ratanasara. Gonna keep his name alive. He died in May of 2000 at the age of 80, which I'm sure made him feel good because the Buddha died at the age of 80 as well. So how did I meet Dr. Ratanasara? Well, in 1979, I came here to IBMC to learn how to meditate, and we had Shinzen Young, the vice abbot, who was teaching meditation. And I listened to him, and it didn't make any sense at all, but I kept coming back because I realized there was something about it that was probably good, and that I probably needed to do if I wanted to be a better person. So from 79 to the early 80s, once a week, once every other week, I would come here and Shinzen would talk and I'd listen, and he had the best Dharma talks. I didn't understand half of what he was saying, but he had the best Dharma talks. And a lot of other people knew what he was saying. And so I figured, well, if they knew, I could find out eventually as well. So one day after the meditation, I said to him, you know, I'd really like to meet somebody who's from early Buddhist tradition of Theravada. Could you recommend anybody to me? So I could sort of find out how it all started. And Shinzen said, yeah, I can. There's a Buddhist temple on Crenshaw Boulevard, Dharmavijaya Buddhist Vihara, and there's a monk there named Dr. Ratnasara. And he's been in America for a couple of years now, and he has a class every Wednesday, which is open to the public. So he would be a good place to start. So I said, okay. So the next Wednesday, I went to Dharmavijaya Buddhist Vihara and knocked on the door, and Dr. Ratnasara answered the door. I says, I'm here for the class. He says, it starts next week. I said, okay. So I went back the following week, and the class started. It was me and him. I was the class. So he had an interesting way of doing it. He said, we're going to study this book. I said, okay. You know, one book or another, it didn't matter to me. And the book was the Visuddhimagga, The Path of Purification, 900 pages long. I said, this is going to take us a while to get through this one. And what I would do is I would sit down and he'd be over there and I'd be over here and I'd read a page from the book. And then he would say, do you have any questions? I said, nope. We go to the next page. I'd read the next page. Do you have any questions? Nope. So, you know, a lot of the stuff I didn't understand, but I figured I didn't even know what kind of question to ask. You know, there's something about asking the right question to get the right answer, and I didn't have any right questions. So I just read. and listened. And then some of the stuff I was curious about was, did you guys back then have toothbrushes? He said, oh yeah, we had toothbrushes. It was like a little root, and you rub the end of the root and it would get all bristly, and that's what we use for a toothbrush. So that's sort of where I was. It wasn't deep Dharma discussions. I was just curious, how did they live? How did they brush their teeth? Did all the teeth fall out? Because they didn't have dentists back then. So we kept going and kept going, and then I started to find out more and more about him. And I was just blown away. Because, you know, you see a monk in a robe and you just go, oh, he's a monk, and that's cool. But a lot of monks don't do anything. They meditate, they share the Dharma, and that's about it. But this guy was busy. 1957, he was the UN representative for Sri Lanka. First monk ever to go and represent Sri Lanka in the UN. I thought, that is so cool, you know? Then, in 1980, he founded the Buddhist Sangha Council of Southern California. So he was creating an interreligious council among Buddhists. No, not the Christians, but among Buddhists. So we had the Thai, and we had the Sri Lankan, and we had the Japanese, and we had the Chinese, and we have all these different kinds of Buddhists coming together and sharing experiences and having goals and working together and stuff like that. Man. He also started the American Buddhist Congress. He was co-founder of the American Buddhist Congress. And that was an organization that was put together to give American Buddhists a voice. Because in LA, everybody's here. And he was very much a supporter of American Buddhism. He wanted to get it established. He wanted it to make a difference in America. He also started with Monsignor Royal Vatican, the LA Buddhist Catholic Dialogue, which is still in operation today. They meet once a month, and they have topics that they talk about. They share their perspectives, the Catholics and the Buddhists. And I can remember back in the 80s, Dr. Ratnasar said, why don't you come with us, Reverend Karuna, Dr. Ratnasar, and me. Why don't you come with us, and you can see what it's all about. So I said, okay. Now, I wasn't ordained then. I was wearing my civvies, and I went and sat in on the... And I couldn't believe how smart everybody was. I'm thinking, what the hell are they talking about? You know, we got between the Buddhists and the Catholics, most of them have master's degrees, a lot of them have PhDs, and they're really esoteric subjects that not most people wouldn't talk about or even understand. But I was fascinated, because I'm always fascinated about how much I don't know. And the older I get, the less I know. Pretty soon, I won't know anything. And then I will have reached the epitome of wisdom. Because only the very wise say, I don't know. So it got me thinking, you know, in an interfaith way, in an interreligious way, that this is important stuff. Because we have an amazing amount of diversity, but as the Buddha said, it's all connected. So how do we come together and be on the same page, but not be one? You know, and that's the deal. Everybody says, well, we're all one. And we all know that that's not the case, because we're all different. So what I like to say is, no, we're not all one, but we are all connected, whether we see it or not. So I don't need to be one with you. We're already there. And most people just listen to that and go, what are they talking about? Those Buddhists, what do they know? So my interreligious and interfaith journey started because Dr. Ratnasara took me to a Buddhist Catholic dialogue. And it just fascinated me. Now, in 1994, Dr. Ratnasara and Reverend Karuna had a grand ordination. And that's where I took my novice ordination. And it was an amazing event. Only in California, maybe New York, but only in California is this stuff going to happen. So we had ordination masters from a variety of traditions. We had people being ordained from a variety of traditions. And one of the things that stood out to me was there was a family, a mother and a father and a daughter. And the daughter was in her 20s. And they were Vietnamese. And they were all getting ordained that day together. And then after the ordination ceremony, they all went to different temples. And I'm going, wow, what a trip that is. They were really devoted. And they really wanted to be ordained. And those are the kind of people that make the best monks and nuns, the ones that want to be ordained. So in my world of interfaith, I started with the Buddhist Catholic dialogue. And then after 9/11, they were having a conference in Indiana on a book called Benedict's Dharma. Now, the rule of Saint Benedict is something that has been followed by monks for hundreds of years. And it's sort of their, you know, it's sort of their manual. And this book was put together by Buddhists and Catholics, and they interviewed Buddhists who had read the rule of Saint Benedict, and they were commenting on it. There was a commentary on it. Now, this book is still available. You can find it on Amazon.com. It's called Benedict's Dharma. But because it was just after 9/11, nobody wanted to go to the conference because they had to fly, and they were afraid to fly because everybody thought the next plane was going to blow up. Okay. So they asked me, through Dr. Ratnasara and the Buddhist Catholic Dialogue, would you like to be part of Benedict's Dharma in Indiana? And we'll fly you there, and we'll give you a place to stay. And you won't have to say anything. You'll just be part of the audience. And I said, sure, I'll go. And the plane flight, hardly anybody was in the plane. Those were the good old days. You know, and I was there, and I met people, and things started. And then I found out about MID, Monastic Interreligious Dialogue, which is an international organization, but has a national chapter. And I got on their list. They always were trying to find Buddhists to join the Catholic monastics, and then they would have different topics. One of them was celibacy. How do Catholics look at celibacy? How do Buddhists look at celibacy? Do they look at it the same? So that was one of the Monks in the West conference that was part of the MID. Monks in the West, Nuns in the West. Reverend Karuna did a lot of those, Nuns in the West conferences. And then they had the Gethsemane Encounter. Gethsemane is where Thomas Merton used to live. And they would get together, and that would be another part of it, another conference. And so I was part of that. And it was a wonderful experience because I learned so much. And I saw there was a lot of similarities between Catholic monastics and Buddhist monastics. In particular, lifestyle. A lot of them live in monasteries, and they have a structured environment. It's done by time and habit. Pardon the pun. And so it was like, yeah, okay. You know, and I just learned a whole lot about these guys. And these guys were good. I enjoyed them. When you see a Catholic monk, it's a little different than a city priest who has a congregation and runs the church. And the monks are cloistered in their way, and they read a lot, and they think a lot. And they do stuff differently than the Catholic priests. It's the same with the Buddhists. The Buddhist in L.A., would be a little different than the Buddhists who live out in the country in a monastery. And one of the things, I think it was Geshe Gelson, who said something. I was at a conference with Geshe Gelson and some other Buddhists, and we were up in Northern California. And we stopped for lunch. We're driving up there in a caravan, and we stopped for lunch. And so in our conversation, Geshe Gelson said that American monastics are like white crows, very rare indeed. And as I look around and see American monastics or Dharma teachers, very rare indeed, you know? And often the voice is unheard to the extent of the Asian monastics, because they've had a tradition of Buddhism for 2,000, 2,500 years. We've had it 150 years, 100 years. We're just the babies. We're just learning. But the one thing that we have that Asian monastics don't have is a cultural background. Our culture is in us. We carry it with us wherever we go. We have a particular way of looking at stuff. We have a particular way of talking about stuff, understanding stuff. Okay. And that's going to be necessary when the American lay people come and ask you, what is Buddhism? What does Buddhism mean to you? Now, if I'm in Thailand and I'm Thai, Buddhism has a whole different meaning than if I'm in LA and born in Iowa. Got a whole different meaning. So how exciting is it to find out that the Catholics and the Buddhists and all the different traditions, and that Buddhism is finally here in America? How exciting is it that we're all in the vanguard? We're all helping create American Buddhism. And that's exactly what Dr. Ratnasara wanted. He wanted us to have our own Buddhism. And that's remarkable, because you don't hear that often. And he supported us in so many different ways. And in that ordination that he did with Reverend Karuna in 1994 here, it was apparent. It was apparent that he was a cheerleader, that he wanted us to succeed and finally come to a place of American Buddhism. Now, one of the things I've realized is that a lot of American monastics and Dharma teachers are second career. They weren't born into the temple. Though Dr. Ratnasara started his tenure in the temple when he was a teenager. Parents said, yeah, you can go to the temple and learn how to be a monk. I think he was 14 or 15. He was just a young guy. So I was 44. And I'm thinking, yeah, that was the second half. That was the first half of my life. Now there's the second half of the life. And people say, well, do you wish you had gone into being a monastic earlier? And I said, no. I needed to find out why life was filled with suffering. I needed to understand what the Buddha was talking about. And if I had been a monk since I was 14, I might have a different way of looking at it. But, you know, when you're in the world and you're just like seeing all the stuff going on, you're trying to get the next job, you're trying to go to lunch, your car breaks down, you don't have enough money for rent, all these things. And then you come to Buddhism and you go, wow, that's it. This is the answer. And then you accept the role of a monk or nun, and then you try to share what you've learned with people who are asking the questions. And I always warn people, you know, I can't answer those questions that you're asking. I can only tell you how I think about it. I can only point in a certain direction, but I can't tell you what to look at. I can't tell you what to see, because we're all different. So as I evolved from the guy who didn't understand what Shinzen was talking about to going to listen to Dr. Ratnasara and seeing how amazing monks can be in the world, and then becoming one myself, and then starting my interreligious journey, and then also starting my engaged Buddhism journey. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about engaged Buddhism. And I never really meant that much to me before. But now I see my book is all about engaged Buddhism. It's about getting out into the world and making a difference. So when I was a ride-along police chaplain, when I was, you know, a volunteer at Juvenile Hall, when I was a volunteer at State Prison, when I was a volunteer at UCLA, that's engaged Buddhism. That's taking what you know and bringing it to the situation, bringing it to the party. Now, will everybody understand what you're saying? No, they won't. Will everybody care? No, they won't. But that's not your job to make them care or understand. Your job is simply to show up and do what you do, and then you leave and get ready for the next time, and the next time, and the next time. And one day, according to Mahayana Buddhism, everybody will end their suffering and the world will be a wonderful place. But the problem for me when I read that the first time was that, well, we've got 8 billion people. We don't have that many monks and nuns out there to address 8 billion people about the question of suffering. And more importantly, the end of suffering. And not only that, but everybody's dying, and then twice as many people are taking their place. So we're looking at 9 billion, 10 billion. So again, it's not about the destination. It's about the journey. Because the destination of ending suffering is not going to happen. But the journey of ending suffering happens every day. Happens every day. So, ironically, I got a call from St. John's Abbey. Father William, Kusala, we need your help. Catholic monk, St. John's Abbey, Minnesota, they need my help. I said, well, what can I do, Father William? What would you like me to do? What do you need from me? We need to talk to you. Ooh. The ancient wisdom of Buddhism. They need to hear the American guy talk about it. No, Kusala, we need to hear how you did your social media. How do you do YouTube? Is Facebook a good platform to have? What can we do to get, you know, I'm going, yeah, I can help you with that too. So sometimes wisdom takes all different kinds of dress. This is wise, and this is wise, and this is wise. So next Saturday, I'll be on Zoom with 5 Catholic monks talking about social media platforms. Yeah. So you never know in your journey of life what will be useful later on, and what will be important later on. And at some point, if you're lucky, you won't know anything, and you'll have finally reached perfection. Thank you for listening.